President Morgan, Chairman Wanneke, I am highly honored by the degree you have just awarded me. I am grateful to Colorado State University, to your State Board of Agriculture, and to your faculty. Your generous and extravagantly flattering citation and words of introduction touch me deeply. I shall always wear with pride the hood that you have given me this evening. Thank all of you very much. President Morgan, members of the State Board of Agriculture, members of the faculty, members of the graduating class, and your guests, ladies and gentlemen. Colorful Colorado has always been a magnet for Americans not privileged to live in your beautiful state. Your mountains, your climate, your zest for life in the Western tradition makes this a most attractive Mecca. All of this you know. It is a real privilege to come to Colorado again and to have the opportunity to see the many changes that have come about at Colorado State University in recent years. President Morgan, the members of your governing board, the faculty, the students, and the people of Colorado are to be congratulated upon the progress that has been made here, a sound, steady progress that has thrust Colorado State into the front rank of American universities. These are not the polite remarks of a casual guest. My afternoon spent in meeting with a considerable number of Michigan State alumni on your faculty, meeting with your board, and the complete tour of your campus under the guidance of a Michigan State alumnus, Vice President Chamberlain, has made this a thrilling experience. This university today evidences sound planning and execution of an intelligent plan for future development. And I hope that I may have the opportunity to come back again in another 5 or 10 years to see what can be one of the outstanding universities of this country. It may surprise you to learn that there is an old mystical tie between Colorado and Michigan State University. Much of the early design for this institution was copied from an older sister, our Michigan State University, the oldest of the land-grant colleges. Even the name of your governing board, the basic original plan, with reference to curricular arrangement and the like, were largely borrowed from MSU. A considerable number of graduates of Michigan State were early settlers in this state. George Eaton, one of the earliest graduates of MSU, came to Colorado in April of 1870, a few months after his graduation with a class of 69. He was a member of the Union Colony, which founded the city of Greeley. Eaton remained at Greeley, engaged mostly in farming, until September of 1879, when, in the words of our alumni historian of that era, and these are the words of that historian, not mine, Eaton was engaged by Indian agent Meeker to go to the White River Agency to assist him in teaching the Indians how to cultivate the soil. The Indians rebelled against this idea and, without further well-known cause, arose in force and massacred the members of the agency. Eaton's body was found by the soldiers of General Merritt's command near the agency on the 11th of October. This massacre is regarded as one of the most cruel and uncalled for of any in the history of our treatment of the Indians. No punishment has ever been meted out to the Indians for the crime, and poor Eaton's body lies buried near the spot where it was found. And I again repeat, those are not my words, but copied from a historical note. Now, this little footnote to history is called to your attention, not alone to demonstrate that Michigan State University has indeed a tie to early Colorado, but to illustrate the more important point that the history of our country is very short and almost contemporary. Instruction began here at Fort Collins on this campus the very same year as the massacre of the White River Agency, in which this early MSU alumnus met his death. While some men were still struggling on the frontiers of civilization to win this portion of the West, others were struggling to lay down a cornerstone of the foundation for a great university to help build the great America we know. And looking at Colorado today and at Colorado State University, one finds it hard to believe that this episode occurred only 84 years ago. All of this progress has occurred in the lifetime of living people, and the lifetime of a man covers a very short period in history. Remembering that so little time has elapsed and so much has been accomplished, it is easier to understand why the land-grant universities, and particularly those which stand as independent institutions, are just beginning to come into their own. They are destined to play increasingly influential roles in the future, and I speak to this point with some feeling and much experience and possibly some bias, because Michigan State, like Colorado State, has had to work hard to gain the recognition it deserves. One recent evidence that they are coming into their own is the fact that they are now generally known as universities rather than as A&M colleges or state colleges. And this welcome and deserved change has come about only within the last 10 years, decades after they had in fact become universities. The change was made grudgingly in many instances. And now that long battle for vindication has been won, and we can reflect philosophically upon the fact that educational prestige is achieved only long after it is deserved on the basis of performance. And the other side of the coin is another fact, that academic prestige often persists long after it ceases to be merited on the basis of true distinction. The separated land-grant colleges, now universities, of which there were a total of 24, had been well accepted for years by their blood relatives, the state universities that are unified land-grant colleges, of which there were also 24. But now the hand of fellowship is being extended with less and less reservation by all other universities, public and private alike. And it is good for the future of America that this is so, for there is so much to be done, so many students to educate, so much research to be done, so many new demands to satisfy, that we cannot afford to handicap any university through an artificial educational caste system. Working together in harmony and in mutual respect, we shall have more than we can do well to meet the challenges with which we are confronted. It is interesting to take a minute to inquire into why and how the separated land-grant universities have finally won the recognition they deserve. And the answers may suggest whether they will play increasingly influential roles in the future, as I believe they will. Their growing recognition is not a particular tribute to those who serve these institutions today. This generation of leaders are not supermen who have conquered where others failed in earlier years. Their success is instead another vindication of the land-grant philosophy first expounded more than a century ago and given formal endorsement and a chance to prove its validity by the Federal Land-Grant Act of 1862. That philosophy was explained at great length last year when we were in the midst of a nationwide land-grant centennial celebration. Boiled down to the essence, the land-grant educational philosophy is based on a conviction that liberal and practical education should be made available at minimum cost to all who are qualified to seek it. Senator Morrill of Vermont, the author of the Land-Grant College Act, was plugging primarily for an education for farmers and mechanics, but he saw something beyond that first objective. In his eloquent speech on behalf of his first bill, he exhorted his congressional colleagues in these words, and this is a quote: "Pass this measure and we shall have done something to enable the farmer to raise two blades of grass instead of one, something for cheap scientific education, something for every man who loves intelligence and not ignorance, something to remove the last vestige of pauperism from our land, something for peace and good order, something to enable the people to bear the enormous expenditures of national government." The end of the quote. In his veto message, President Buchanan made this profound comment, and this is a quote. "It is extremely doubtful, to say the least, whether the bill would contribute to the advancement of agriculture and the mechanic arts." End of the quote. 3 years later, Abraham Lincoln urged the Congress to repass the Morrill Act. It was passed, and he signed it into law in 1862. Time has vindicated President Lincoln and Morrill and those who voted with him, and time has vindicated those colleges and universities which have worked faithfully to put Morrill's ideas into practice, to transmute his dream into reality. Time has repudiated the view of Buchanan and the prejudices of those who thought that nothing good could come from a college that admittedly sought to offer practical education to the children of working people, the so-called industrial classes of that day. The professions and vocations for which we prepare young people have gained in social acceptability as they have grown in importance to our economic well-being. A family no longer apologizes for a son who is not preparing to be a doctor or a lawyer or a clergyman. Other professions have pushed up to take their places alongside the so-called learned professions. An engineer is no longer referred to as an educated mechanic, as he once was called. The business executive or successful farmer is fully accepted in our society, in legislative halls, and in political leadership. Our alumni are occupying more and more positions of power and prestige. They speak with pride of the colleges from which they came, and they support them vigorously and generously. And this accounts in part for the recent success of the land-grant colleges. Americans are not snobbish or class conscious. They tend to judge the man himself and what he does, rather than by such artificial standards as who his grandfather was and what college he attended. And this has worked for the benefit of the colleges that were once called cow colleges. And a more important reason for the growing prestige of the land-grant universities is that the soundness of their educational philosophy has been demonstrated so consistently over such a long period of time that no one questions it seriously. The American people have come to agree that all legitimate human activities are fit subjects for academic attention. They have come to agree that it is desirable for increasing numbers of young men and women to be prepared through education to contribute economically, socially, and politically to the strengthening of our way of life. The value of making educational opportunities readily available has come to be accepted, and the institutions that first testified to that value through their works are being deservedly accepted for what they are. The value of the contribution universities can make to the economic development of the country through research is being recognized. And this is a relatively recent development. Research has come to be a meaningful word in the vocabularies of business and industrial leaders, city councils, chambers of commerce, the real estate promoters. It is this lure with which they hope to attract new industries and create new jobs, as new industries have been attracted to New England and California and thousands of new jobs created thereby. And happy is the community today that has a research-oriented university in its midst. And there's nothing wrong with this approach. Universities should and do serve the industrial segment of our economic system, and they should and do serve other segments. Universities are gratified that the business and industrial community is turning to them for help in recognition of their vital importance. They only wish support from business and industry for universities matched the volume of demands for help. And we who have studied and served in land-grant institutions smile a little ruefully because this recognition of the importance of research to industry is so belated. What is being asked of us now is exactly what we have been doing for the basic industry of agriculture for three quarters of a century, since the passage of the Hatch Act in 1887. It is now generally recognized that what the land-grant colleges did through teaching, research, and extension to make an American agriculture more efficient brought indirect but enormous benefits to non-agricultural industry as well. This is an old story, but well worth retelling. By making farming more efficient, we freed increasing numbers of Americans to work in industry which could plan for growth and development with assurance that there would be an ample supply of labor. And America's industrial preeminence has its roots in American agriculture. It is surprising that it has taken business and industry so long to recognize the potential value of research to their prosperity. And perhaps we threw them off the scent by calling our research centers agricultural experiment stations. If we had called them something like biological research centers or even agricultural science research centers, they might have caught the notice of the industrial and business world long ago. Deserved recognition is sweet. All of us are gratified by recent events. What should concern us more is the question, what of the future? This is of particular concern to those who receive their degrees this evening from Colorado State University. The value of today's degrees will vary in value as the fortunes of Colorado State University vary. If Colorado State continues to grow in strength and usefulness, as I am sure it will, then the diplomas certifying the completion of the course of study here becomes more valuable. Should you permit the prestige of your alma mater to falter, the value of your degrees will falter too. The fortunes and future of this university will, in a sense, and to a degree, rest in your hands. The future is bright for all higher education. There will be no diminution in the demand for college graduates in a society becoming increasingly complex and difficult to manage. There will be no lessening in the demand for research of the kind that universities are uniquely qualified to perform. The American people will not give up their belief in the importance of education at all levels. The land-grant universities are in a particularly strong position because of their long experience in both basic and applied research, an experience on which they can build expanding programs of vital importance in many fields. And the next great forward thrust in scientific discovery and development will be in the biological sciences, a very real strength of the land-grant colleges. Clark Kerr, the distinguished president of the University of California, discussed this point in a recent address at Howard University, and this is what he said, and this is a quote. The fastest growing intellectual field today is biology. The code of life can now be read. Soon it will be understood, and after that, used. It is an intellectual discovery of unique and staggering proportions. The secrets of the atom may hold no greater significance, much as they have changed and are changing human activity on this planet, than the secrets still hidden in the genetic code. If the first half of the 20th century may be said to have belonged to the physical sciences, the second half may well belong to the biological. Resources within the universities will be poured into the new biology and into the resulting new medicine and agriculture, well supported as medicine and agriculture already are. End of the quote. It would have delighted Senator Morrill to have heard agriculture equated with medicine as an intellectual area of great importance. The land-grant universities, including this one, have been involved in an extensive program of technical assistance to nations overseas. As a consequence, they are assembling valuable bodies of knowledge and faculties of remarkable experience and knowledge of world affairs. These overseas activities undertaken for the best of altruistic reasons will pay on-campus dividends in the years ahead. It is difficult to think of any major enterprise in this country that will not be related in some manner to and affected in some manner by international affairs, business, industry, commerce, and government. will be recruiting more and more young people to serve overseas or in domestic responsibilities requiring some knowledge of international affairs. Faculty members who themselves have had experience abroad bring an important first-hand experience and appreciation of the interdependence of today's world into their classroom teaching. But there is at least one cloud in the bright skies. Questions are being asked. Education will cost a lot of money. Where is it coming from? There are no ready-made answers, no design for a printing press to turn out painlessly the millions of dollars that will be needed. We are not persuaded that the United States cannot afford what it must have. If it is to grow in strength and prosper materially, more higher education is one of the prerequisites. We are not influenced by those who haggle at the size of the investment required, noting the alacrity with which we build superhighways and the relative ease with which we finance them, and noting the cost of flying to the moon and how willingly we ante up the necessary billions of dollars. We are not persuaded that America is too poor to educate her sons and daughters just because there are suddenly so many of them. We are a little ashamed to have us beg poverty when we read the recent UNESCO estimate that to give each child 8 years of primary education in the following countries would cost at current prices about 0.8% of the national income in the United States, 1.7% of the national income in Jamaica, 2.8% of the national income in Ghana, and 4% of the national income in Nigeria. At Michigan State University, we know something about Nigeria because we helped establish the University of Nigeria, and we are lending considerable assistance to it. The people of Nigeria, the most promising country in all of Black Africa, are hungry for education, as are the people of many of the world's new nations. They mean to have education for their people, no matter what the cost. They see education as the only means by which they can lift themselves and strengthen themselves to cope with the problems of the modern world. They are seeking to emulate the people of America. They give widespread education, not our natural resources, not our political system, the credit for making this the strongest country in the world. We have set them an example, and they mean to follow it. This is the American example the Russians are following too. The Russians are not only following our example, they intend to outdo us by offering free educations to their ablest youth through the highest levels in their best graduate schools. And this education free. They intend to beat us if they can by copying our dedication to widespread educational opportunity for all able young people. One difference between the developing countries and our own is that many of them are willing to establish priorities, and they put education in top place. If we are indeed at the breaking point in taxation, as some contend, then we too must have the courage and the wisdom to determine what is more important and what is less important, and allocate our tax funds accordingly. Once upon a time, the American people had this all straight in their mind. The early pioneers built a schoolhouse soon after they had built their homes, often before they built the church. They opened the doors of Colorado State University here at Fort Collins while Indians were massacring well-meaning farmers 150 miles to the west. They established the land-grant colleges and pledged a large share of the national treasure of public lands to their support in the middle of a civil war, when the very survival of the nation was in doubt. They knew what was essential to the future of their country. They knew what was important. They chose education and they backed their choice with their scanty dollars. Do we of this day have less wisdom, less vision, less courage than those whose heirs we are? What we have today was made possible by those who made their choice, and properly, in days long faded into history. What legacy do we leave to the generations to come after us? Is it to be only a notation that we loved our comforts and conveniences and our luxuries too much, that we could not bring ourselves to sacrifice when sacrifice was indicated, that we were not smart enough to put first things first? What we urgently need is a national declaration of purpose. We need to declare our renewed intention to do whatever is needed to ensure broadening of educational opportunities for our young people, to ensure that our schools, colleges, and universities will continue to grow in strength as instruments of social usefulness, and to ensure that coming generations will inherit an educational legacy better and finer than we inherited from those who have gone before. The need for such a declaration of purpose is not the need of the colleges and universities. It is the need of the nation itself. The crisis in education is not the crisis of the colleges and universities. It is a crisis of young Americans who may be denied their educational heritage and for their fathers and mothers. Colleges and universities are but the agencies of the American people through which they have in the past lifted themselves farther, economically, socially, politically, culturally, than any other people anywhere in a comparable period of time. What happens to these institutions is not important in itself. What is important is what the American people decide should happen to this nation, now and in the future. If they want the nation to develop and prosper, they will see to it that their colleges are adequately maintained, all kinds of colleges, private and public, large and small. In this day and age, above all others, it is true that if we want to move ever forward, we must rely increasingly upon more and more higher education, teaching, and research. The explosion of knowledge must be kept up with and encouraged. And now and finally, as we congratulate all of you who are today completing your work at this university, and receiving your degrees, and setting out in a variety of directions, and say to each of you that we wish for you success and happiness, we would also remind you that you who are graduating this evening will have much to say when tomorrow's decisions are made. Your advice and counsel will have weight with your fellow citizens. You who have received the benefits of higher education at a land-grant university, supported with tax funds, have good reason to appreciate the value of the opportunity Colorado State University presents and the generosity of the taxpayers of this state that have made your educations possible. And you have an obligation to help persuade your fellow citizens that the doors of opportunity must remain open to those who will follow you if our country is to achieve its destiny, if it is to remain strong and proud and free. Millions of young people throughout the world envy what you have here. Do you value it enough to preserve, protect, and defend it for those to follow you? We believe you do. We must believe that, or the future holds little promise for any of us and little promise for our country. Thank you.